From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. What makes a good cop go bad?
It's a slow, painful process, but it is a process.
That's David Cruz. He was a Border Patrol agent in Laredo, Texas from 2001 to 2007.
What was your dream? I mean, did you always want to become a Border Patrol agent?
I always wanted to do law enforcement. It all began when I was in the Navy.
After a four-year stint in the Navy, he got a job with a sheriff's department in Ohio. He worked at a halfway house at a jail until finally...
I ended up at the Border Patrol Academy.
But from the start, David felt uneasy with the Border Patrol.
From the time that you go to an academy, you learn that it's not really a migrant, but a wetback. And, you know, how many wets did you get and how many wets did you caught? And did you catch them? You clean them? And, you know, it's constantly being talked about, not like a human being, but perhaps as a fish. If you catch them, you clean them.
But he got past his initial discomfort and became an agent.
Can you kind of walk me through your day-to-day as a Border Patrol agent? So you get up and you go to work, and what's the average day like?
There isn't really an average day. One day you might be following some footprints out in the desert. Another day you might be inspecting some vehicles in the checkpoint. You may be assigned to a canine unit or... you know, different things.
So how did you end up getting into the trouble that you did?
I'd like to make something clear, and it's that every agent has smuggled illegal aliens. Perhaps you were just a lazy agent, and you let them through just because you don't like to process the paperwork. When you apprehend one person, you take the risk of, after... everybody's going home, you having to stay in process for another 2 or 3 hours. It's easy for a lot of people to say, well, how do I avoid that? I just let them through. I don't do my job, period.
We can't verify David's statement, but we can say the morale at the agency was really low. Other former agents told us the same thing, and the Border Patrol Union has talked about it publicly. But no matter how low the morale was, or how much David may have disliked his job, it didn't cause him to break the law. That was something else entirely. Cash.
I was married at the time, and there was a dispute with my wife's son at the time. His father had taken him to Mexico, and we were in a legal battle to get him back. That legal battle was very costly, and that was the beginning of it. I said, okay, well, we need to get him back. I'll do what I need to do to get him back, and you're just gonna go along. And that's pretty much how it was.
And so how did you meet the coyote that brought these people in? Is that how it worked?
I wanted to make sure that the person that I was going to be involved with had to be somebody that would not mistreat the people, and that the people wouldn't talk about them. Of course, I didn't want to get caught.
So you basically went out searching for somebody.
Them.
Yeah, like nobody propositioned you. You kind of went out looking for it.
No, it was the other way around, right? I was the one that propositioned. After many interviews with many aliens that I was catching, I found enough information about somebody that was treating him well, somebody that would fit that description, you know, somebody that I could work with and know that wasn't abusing the people.
How did you get people through?
The person I contacted would take care of helping them cross the river. They were placed in a safe house where they were fed and they were, you know, taken care of until the time was right to take him to a bus station, get him a bus ticket.
The undocumented immigrants would get on a bus and David's wife would call him
with the information about the bus, the number, the time where they were going, and how many people were in there that I was supposed to let through. I was at the checkpoint, and I needed to make sure that I was the one that would get up in that bus and do the inspection and wave those people through.
Do you have any idea how many times you did that? I mean, it just sounds so tense.
I don't know how many times I did.
Would it be safe to say it was in, like, you know, double digits?
I would say that I pled guilty to an information that says that it was 25 people that I helped come into the United States illegally.
What was that shift like in your mind to go from, like, you know, trying to be a good officer into seeing this as a way to make money? Did you know other agents that were doing the same thing that you did?
No, I had never met anybody that was making money doing this. No, it is a long and very painful process that changes you from a very good agent to somebody that's doing exactly what you're trying to avoid happening.
But there were other agents who were smuggling people across the border for money. Through a Freedom of Information request to Customs and Border Protection, we found more than 130 cases of corrupt CBP officials in the past dozen years. And that long, painful process David is talking about, some people call it the 7-year itch. It's about the time many good agents turn bad and do things like smuggle people across the border for cash. David made enough money to pay for the custody battle, but instead of walking away from his smuggling business, he kept going.
It shifted. You see, now we're accustomed to a different lifestyle. We were spending a lot of money. We weren't even the same people that started doing it.
How much money were you making?
Well, I don't know if I should get into that. It was
a significant amount of money that you saw.
It was a significant amount of money, yes.
You saw a change in your lifestyle. Like, you know, whereas you might have been going to Olive Garden, now you're going to a 4-star restaurant, right? Like that type of thing?
Yes. There was a big change in lifestyle.
We tried to find out how much money, but our search of court records didn't answer that question. David says it wasn't just the money that kept him in the game. It was fear.
Let's not forget that I'm making money, but I'm also making money for other people. And now I had the problem of going to those people saying, I don't want to do this anymore. Well, it's not that simple. You know, where you're working with certain people, you just don't go and say, get ready not to make the money that you're getting used to making with me, because it's not going to happen anymore. So that's a whole set of troubles that I had to deal with.
About 6 years into the job, David starts to feel like his bosses are on to him. Passwords stop getting him into certain systems, co-workers act differently around him, and then one day, he's working at an immigration checkpoint. His wife calls him, letting him know that a bus is coming through with some undocumented immigrants. When it arrives, he waves them through, but then he notices something. One of his fellow border agents is on that bus.
I called my wife at the time. And I said, this is it. There's no if or buts. This, I know, was an agent. And I know witnessed me allowing through some people in this bus. So you can mark this day that this is when we got caught.
That incident spooked David enough that he decided to resign. It was September of 2007. A few months later, immigration and customs agents arrested him and his wife. He made bail and decided to flee to Mexico, where he became a fugitive. He knew he would eventually get caught, and that made him think a lot about those undocumented immigrants.
Having to change my identity, having to go through a lot of hoops, I ended up exactly where these people came from. And I lived what most of the people I allowed through had lived before they came through. And I'm not saying that allowing these people through was a good thing. I'm saying that for me personally, to be put in that position and live the way they lived and have that hardship was incredibly
humbling.
Yes, it allowed me to grow so much.
David was eventually captured in Mexico. He pleaded guilty to smuggling people across the border in exchange for cash and spent more than 4 years in prison. His wife also served about 4 years for the same charges. In the years since his release from prison, he studied for a degree at a university in Puerto Rico where he has family, and he wishes he could talk to Border Patrol agents today to stop those who are thinking of doing something wrong. Do you think adding more border agents would just make the problem worse?
I think it will, because in order to... It's almost like an army, you know, and when you send that army down there to the border, southern border especially, to work, you have to give them that pep talk, you know, go get those wets. Go get these people that are making your great America bad. So you're sending an army with a lot of rage, with a lot of negativity, with a lot of disrespect in their mind, and this is the problem.
Corruption in customs and border protection is a huge problem. Reports commissioned by the agency found we have no idea how big the problem is. We're not just talking about agents working at checkpoints on the border, but across the country, agents who let people and illegal drugs in. And these agents, in some cases, made millions of dollars working for violent drug cartels. Now, we've seen lives cut short and families disrupted by the drug wars in Mexico. But last year, prosecutors say the carnage washed up on U.S. shores. It's March 2015 in the tropical bays of South Texas. It's a crime that's become common across the border, but this murder mystery begins in a Texas border town and eventually leads to a Border Patrol agent. Nina Satija and Jay Root of our partner at the Texas Tribune have our story.
The Border Patrol agent in question, Joel Luna. He was arrested in November of 2015. Like many agents accused of corruption, he had a distinguished record of military service. He'd been with the Border Patrol for 6 years. His arrest sent shockwaves through the agency. Recently, my colleague Jay went on a ride-along with another Border Patrol agent, one who, by a stroke of luck, happened to know Joel.
Yeah, you know what? Regarding that guy, Joel Luna, he actually was my partner out here for a while.
You knew
I worked
him?
With him. Yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah, I worked with him for a while. And the guy was, you know, we'd go for walks, and he was just there with me all the time. And, you know, again, hey, sir, let's go for a walk, sir. We'd go for a walk, and never suspected anything from him.
You never had any...
Any suspicions?
Nothing.
No.
Wow. What was he like?
He was a cool person. You know, we got along fine. Never had any issues with him. Like I said, it was just when I heard he was Joel Luna, like, no, not Joel Luna.
Before we get back to Joel, though, we want to take you back to the beginning, back to the story that would lead to a Border Patrol agent being charged with capital murder and drug trafficking. And in this case, the beginning happens to be...
Spring break 2015, on South Padre Island, on the southern tip of Texas, just miles from the Mexican border. Every year, tens of thousands of students about to graduate from college show up here for a good time. I'm talking drinks, dancing, live music, but accidents happen too. People get drunk, fall in the water, and sometimes they drown. Last year, though, no one expected this.
A nude and decapitated body was pulled from the waters off South Padre Island Monday night.
The guy who found the body was boating with his two daughters, just off the island. At first, he thought it was a crab trap. As he got closer, it looked like something else.
So he called 911. The response came from officers under Cameron County Sheriff Omar Lucio.
Okay, there was a decapitated body, really. It was a headless body. So at the beginning, you know, like everything else, we didn't have anything to go with.
It was the body's fingerprints that helped authorities identify him.
And the victim was identified as Jose Francisco Palacios Paz.
Frankie Palacios, as he was sometimes known, was an undocumented immigrant from Honduras. His longtime on-and-off girlfriend, Martha, had reported him missing days earlier. They found his body just days after what would have been his 33rd birthday, March 16th, 2015.
Well, it's very unusual. Really, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen that often. At least I've been in law enforcement for a long time, and that doesn't happen that I can recall. At the beginning, it was perhaps believed that it might have been somebody who drowned, and perhaps a big barge or a big boat or what have you might have... cut him off with the propeller.
That was the sheriff's initial hope, as much as you can hope for anything when you find a headless body. Maybe it was just a horrible accident. Maybe there wasn't a killer out there.
But there was a long vertical cut on Frankie's body from the neck down. He had other wounds too, classic signs, Sheriff Lucio said, of a drug cartel hit.
Whoever loses a load or whoever loses the money or whatever the case may be, well, they take revenge that way. We feel that, yes, there was something that was related to the cartel. There's no question about it, especially the type of execution.
It was hard for Sheriff Lucio not to think of this as spillover violence with all the bloody drug wars in Mexico.
The investigators almost felt that it had happened, you know, here, and it had probably happened right there at a tire shop.
That's Veterans Tire Shop. Frankie had worked there for years. We went by the shop a couple of months ago. It's a small brick building painted bright yellow. Tires were stacked inside from floor to ceiling. The doors were wide open with huge fans blowing. No one was there when we walked right in.
Buenas tardes.
Investigators think Frankie was doing more than fixing and selling tires. They think he and some of his coworkers were involved in the Gulf Cartel. That's based just across the border in the Mexican state of Tamaulipas.
Buenas tardes. Hola.
There's a tiny office inside the tire shop, more like a big closet. Inside, there's a small twin bed and a TV, which was on. Frankie often spent the night in this little room. This is where investigators believe he died, March 10, 2015.
Soon after they found Frankie's body, Sheriff Lucio says his team sprayed the walls with something called Blue Star blood-finding agent.
There's a special type of lighting that you can use, and it shows whether, even though it's been cleaned and what have you, will eventually show that at one time or another there was some blood there.
It turned out the blood belonged to Frankie Palacios. The bloodstains were on almost every wall in that little office. By this point, investigators had zeroed in on Frankie's coworkers at the tire shop, especially on Eduardo Luna and Fernando Luna, two brothers.
You might recognize that last name, Luna. There aren't just two brothers. There's a third, the Border Patrol agent, Joel. But nobody knew about him yet. For now, the focus was on Eduardo and Fernando. Investigators found suspicious text messages on Eduardo's phone. Fernando sent them to him the day before Frankie died. The messages said, "This Frankie is a bleeping traitor, and at any moment he's going to snitch on you."
The night of Frankie's death, records show Eduardo Luna's cell phone was on the move. He appeared to be driving to South Padre Island, near where Frankie's body would later be found. Gustavo Garza is the lead prosecutor in the case.
Frankie, the victim, was going to identify the Luna brothers as selling drugs. And we believe that's what led to his demise and to his beheading.
Another thing, there were some curious pictures on Eduardo's phone, like one of a pistol decorated in gold and engraved with the word pájaro, Spanish for bird. That name, Pájaro, would become very important later. For now, though, it was a mystery.
On June 24th, authorities found Eduardo at Veterans Tire Shop and arrested him. As for his brother, Fernando...
Fernando was not arrested at the tire shop on the 24th. Later that night, lo and behold, this vehicle is driving across from Mexico into the U.S., and Fernando Luna sent.
So they found him driving across the border on the same day they found his brother Eduardo and arrested him too. That was the first stroke of luck for authorities. Then there was a second, something nobody saw coming. Fernando wasn't the only one in the car.
And it happened that his brother, Joel, was with him, who was a Border Patrol agent at the time.
This is when investigators first connected Joel Luna to his two brothers, who were already under suspicion.
That raised some pretty obvious questions. Who the heck is Joel Luna? What's his involvement in this case? And what is a Border Patrol agent doing, driving a murder suspect from Mexico into the United States?
Coming up after the break, we talk with Joel Luna's lawyer.
Circumstantially, you look at that and you go, this, I mean, at the minimum, doesn't look good.
I agree that when you look at when it's presented that way, it gives one pause.
That's up next. You're listening to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, listeners. Byer Duncan here from Reveal. During our episode about the student debt crisis, we asked those of you who are still paying off loans to use the hashtag MyDebtCouldBuy and tell us what you could purchase with all that money. We've gotten a bunch of great responses so far. Here's what we heard when we followed up with some of you.
My name is Carolyn. I'm from Long Beach, California, and my debt could buy a fancy Starbucks latte every day for the next 62 years.
My name is Derek. I'm from Avon, Indiana. And my debt could buy my son 5 years of high-quality education at a daycare to prepare him for kindergarten with money to spare.
Hi, my name's Tara. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and my debt could buy a monthly New York City Metro Pass for the next 50 years.
That's just a sampling. You can find many more creative submissions by checking out the hashtag MyDebtCouldBuy on Twitter or by visiting revealnews.org/mydebt.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Today's show is all about good cops gone bad. To be more specific, federal law enforcement protecting our borders. Nina Satija and Jay Root are investigative reporters at our partner, the Texas Tribune. They've been looking into the case of Border Patrol agent Joel Luna. He's been accused of murder and drug trafficking along with his two brothers, Eduardo and Fernando Luna. All three Luna brothers are suspected members of the Gulf Cartel. They've all pleaded not guilty. There have been no trials yet, but a lot of evidence is coming to light. For one thing, investigators found curious pictures on Eduardo's phone. There were pictures of a gun engraved in gold with the Spanish word for bird, pájaro. They didn't know the significance of it at first, but it would become important later. Through public documents, interviews, and information from sources close to the investigation, Nina and Jay piece together what may have happened. Here they are with the rest of our story.
Here's what we know about Joel Luna. He's 31 years old, of Mexican heritage, an Army veteran who served in Iraq, and most recently, an agent for the Border Patrol.
Joel is a patriot.
That's Carlos Garcia, Joel's lawyer.
Anyone that you speak to that knew Joel growing up, that knows Joel as an adult, that knew Joel in the military, or knew Joel while he worked with Border Patrol, has nothing but good things to say about him.
Joel's lawyer said, sure, his brothers may have exchanged text messages the day before a murder, calling the victim a traitor and a snitch.
But yet they have no text messages that tie my client to any criminal act.
The Luna brothers' parents are from the border town of Reynosa, Mexico. Their mom's a housewife. Their dad, who died in 2011, was a cook. Joel spent his childhood in Reynosa along with his brothers, but he was born across the border in Texas, and he went to high school there. Family members told us his mother hoped to get American residency that way. Ultimately, she did.
After high school, Joel joined the Army in 2004. He was still years away from becoming a Border Patrol agent. But around that time, something was happening in Washington that would affect his future career. Congress and the president made sweeping changes to Homeland Security laws.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Thank you all. Please be seated. Good morning. In a few minutes, I will sign into law the most dramatic reform of our nation's intelligence capabilities since President Harry S. Truman signed the National Security Act of 1947.
President George W. Bush is about to sign the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004.
America in this new century again faces new threats. We face stateless networks. We face killers who hide in our own cities. To inflict great harm on our country, Americans' enemies need to be only right once. Our intelligence and law enforcement professionals and our government must be right every single time.
Along with changing defense policy abroad, the law called for doubling the Border Patrol. When the president signed it, there were about 10,500 Border Patrol agents. Today, there are more than 21,000. Now, adding all those agents so quickly had some unintended consequences. First off, the agency didn't have enough internal investigators to keep an eye on potential misconduct. And when it hired all those new people, they didn't always get thorough background investigations. We don't know if corruption within the agency got worse after the hiring surge, because it only started keeping good data in 2004. But corruption was seen as a growing problem, enough that it became the focus of congressional hearings in 2011. Here's Alan Burson speaking at one hearing. He was Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, or CBP.
Since 2004 in October, 127 CBP personnel have been arrested, charged, or convicted of corruption. We take each and every one of them seriously.
The agents had been accused of illegally letting drugs, people, or weapons into the United States. Today, more than 170 have been accused of these crimes. Here's Homeland Security official Charles Edwards from that same hearing.
The cartels, the drug business, organized criminal enterprises, they are becoming very sophisticated. So they are trying to infiltrate our CBP workforce. So we have to get to the root of the problem. If we just go ahead and get rid of that one employee, we still haven't gotten to the bottom of the problem.
Customs and Border Protection declined our request for an interview. But I did speak to James Tomczyk, who headed internal affairs from 2006 to 2014. He said standards for becoming a Border Patrol agent became so low during the hiring surge that drug cartels had their own members apply for Border Patrol jobs.
Did the Gulf Cartel name ever come up?
It did, frequently.
So folks would be told by the Gulf Cartel to apply to become a Border Patrol agent?
Yes, and organizations within the Gulf Cartel, aligned with the Gulf Cartel, would recruit persons from within their ranks solely for the purpose of advancing ongoing criminal activity.
Prosecutors say, and may have to prove in court, that Joel Luna and his two brothers were involved in the Gulf Cartel. We asked James Tomczyk if he'd been surprised to hear about that case.
No, I can't say that it surprises me or shocks me. It is unfortunate that events like that, beyond unfortunate that events like that unfold. But I have come to believe that it is something that should be anticipated.
So we don't know how or when the Gulf Cartel allegedly became a part of Joel Luna's life. But in March of 2013, 4 years on the job, he sent an urgent memo to his supervisors. Joel told them his family in Mexico had been threatened, and they could be hurt if he didn't help the Gulf Cartel. Customs and Border Protection wouldn't release the message to us, and they wouldn't tell us what, if anything, they did in response.
But we know Joel sent that message in March of 2013, and we also know that in that same month, Joel's brother Eduardo may have been caught up in Gulf Cartel violence. After Eduardo was arrested for Frankie's murder, court documents say a woman called investigators out of the blue. She said she knew Eduardo as a Gulf Cartel comandante, or commander, and she said he'd killed her brother, Mario Peña, the guy who this music video is about.
Para Mario Peña, alias El Popo.
Mario Peña was a Gulf Cartel commander too, and the video, which mourns his death, claims he was betrayed by a colleague, shot in the back. The woman who called investigators claimed Eduardo Luna did that, the brother of Border Patrol agent Joel Luna. We can't verify these claims. Many news reports say Mario Peña was killed during Gulf Cartel violence in March of 2013. But there's no proof Eduardo Luna did it. His lawyer didn't respond to multiple emails and phone messages.
But the woman offered an important detail, a Gulf cartel name she knew Eduardo went by, Pájaro. Remember, that's Spanish for bird, the same word engraved on the gun found in pictures on Eduardo's phone. Other elements line up too. Family members told us that in early 2013, Joel's brothers received a threat while having a party in Reynosa. They fled to Texas, where all three Luna brothers, Joel, Eduardo, and Fernando, were reunited. Family members showed us a video of a cousin's birthday party. Joel and Fernando are both there. Joel's hugging his wife tightly, baby son in one arm. He loves to dance and socialize, his family told us. And they just couldn't believe he's in jail now.
Vuelta y vuelta. That's Joel.
And he's been like that all the time. I mean, yeah, since little.
Since I've known him, he's always been like that.
Not only him, but Fernando too.
Yeah, the whole family. Your whole family.
Your whole family is like that.
We're a big family.
That party was in October of 2014, just months before the headless body of Frankie Palacios was found near South Padre Island. Again, all three Luna brothers have pleaded not guilty to all charges. Fernando and Eduardo's lawyers didn't respond to repeated phone calls. Joel's lawyer, Carlos Garcia, says his client is innocent.
I represent Mr. Luna, Joel Luna. What his brothers may have been involved in or did or didn't do have nothing to do with his behavior or what he's accused of in this case. He's not, he has not and did not commit a criminal act.
There is one glaring detail I should mention, though. A family member pointed investigators to a black safe at Joel's mother-in-law's house. Here's Cameron County Sheriff Omar Lucio.
And inside of that safe, there was located over a kilogram of cocaine, 17 grams of methamphetamine, a 1911 style engraved pistol. I think that pistol was engraved with the name of an individual, and it was a beautiful pistol.
That name engraved on the pistol? Pájaro. Finally, investigators had found the gun they'd seen pictured on Eduardo Luna's phone, with the same nickname they'd heard belonged to a Gulf cartel comandante.
By the way, the other side of the gun said Cartel del Golfo, Spanish for Gulf cartel. There was more in that safe. $89,000 in cash, bundled in rubber bands.
The officer also located a United States Border Patrol badge and several documents identifying Joel Luna.
So not only did they find drugs and a pistol with the name Pájaro, they found one of Joel's Border Patrol badges. Jay asked his lawyer about this.
One of his brothers in particular, Eduardo Luna, has been identified in these court documents as a sort of figure, a comandante in the Gulf cartel named El Pájaro. And as it turned out, El Pájaro is the name that's engraved on this gold-plated pistol that has CDG, Cartel del Golfo, Gulf Cartel, written on it. And that was found in this safe, you know, and now they're tying the safe to Joel Luna because it was his safe. And his Border Patrol badge was in there. So circumstantially, you look at that and you go, this, I mean, at the minimum, doesn't look good.
I agree that when you look at, you know, when it's presented that way, it gives one pause to think about, well, what are those two things don't go together. You know, this cartel pistol with the bad guy's name on it shouldn't be with the badge of a border patrolman.
Still, Carlos Garcia says that doesn't implicate Joel Luna.
The safe was not found and was never found and wasn't found in my client's possession.
That's true. It was found at his mother-in-law's house. Both Joel's mother-in-law and other family members told authorities the safe belonged to Joel. His lawyer disputes that.
There's no evidence but for a statement that the government relies on to tie him to that safe.
As soon as investigators found that safe, they arrested Joel Luna and indicted him, like his brothers, for the capital murder of Frankie Palacios and for drug trafficking. Joel was arrested at the checkpoint where he worked in Hebronville, Texas. We don't know which of the town's several checkpoints was the site of his arrest, but we drove through a couple.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Hey, good.
Good, how are you guys? All right.
Just y'all two today?
Okay.
Just the two of us.
We're reporters from the Texas Tribune. We're doing a story about Joel Luna, who used to work here.
I'm sorry, you're doing a what?
A story about Joel Luna.
Oh, okay.
He used to work here.
I understand.
What was it like to work with him?
Sorry, sir. I can't really comment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Was this the station where he worked?
Well,
where we are here.
This is one of the checkpoints, man. But this is the correct area.
Okay.
Okay. And both of you are U.S. citizens?
Yes, we are.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
We sent a long list of questions to Customs and Border Protection. What's the procedure if an employee tells them he's being threatened by a drug cartel? How closely does the agency examine an employee's family background?
Another question. The agency is supposed to conduct background checks on every agent every 5 years. We were told it's up to date on all these so-called 5-year reinvestigations.
That means Joel would have gotten a reinvestigation in 2014, months before Frankie's murder. Did the reinvestigation uncover anything about his family?
Customs and Border Protection wouldn't answer any of our questions about Joel Luna.
The agency is in the process of hiring thousands more law enforcement officers, even though it still doesn't know the extent of corruption in its own ranks.
That story comes to us from the Texas Tribune's Nina Satija and Jay Root. We're going to talk about what it says about border security when we come back in a minute.
Hey there, Cole Goins here from Reveal. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area or the New York City, New Jersey area, we've got two events coming up in July that you won't want to miss. First, we're bringing an original play called Justice in the Embers to the Flight Deck here in Oakland, California, not too far from Reveal headquarters. It's our new Storyworks theater production with KCPT exploring the long-term incarceration of youth in America and a Supreme Court ruling that will change the lives of thousands of juvenile offenders. The show runs from July 21st to the 23rd and will be open for 4 shows only. You can get tickets on our website, revealnews.org/events. For those of you in the New York City area, we're teaming up with radio station WFMU in Jersey City for a project we're calling Toxic Comedy. We'll challenge comedians to come up with original material based on reporting about pollution in New Jersey. We know it may not seem like a laughing matter, but our goal is to find a new way to tell stories about how contamination is affecting people in the Garden State. We're hosting the first event at WFMU's Monty Hall on July 29th. You can get your tickets at montyhall.ticketfly.com. Hope to see you there.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. In this episode, we're examining corruption in U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the front line of law enforcement that prevents people, illegal drugs, and weapons from crossing into this country. The Texas Tribune and Reveal have compiled a database that suggests the problem is about more than just a few bad apples. In the last dozen years, more than 130 Customs and Border Protection officials have been arrested, charged, or convicted of corruption. To talk about it, we've got the Texas Tribune and Reveal's Nina Satija.
Hey, Al.
And Mr. Andy Becker.
Hey, Al.
Who covers the border for Reveal. How you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Doing well.
All right, so my big question here, really simple. How did these people get hired?
It's a really good question and has a very complicated answer.
Yeah, with a number of these individuals, they're relatively recent hires. The Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection has gone through a pretty big expansion over the last decade. There were real challenges that Customs and Border Protection had in being able to properly vet and screen the applicants. They had a very tight deadline given to them by Congress, pressure from the White House saying, we need to build up the border, we got to do Border Patrol and border security, and we need to do it now.
But has that agency been able to handle it? I mean, it seems that even if they bulked up their internal affairs, it still hasn't been enough.
It really hasn't. They went from 5 agents and to about 200 or so almost overnight. And at the same time, they didn't even have the authority to investigate their own for committing crimes. That fell to another agency, the Inspector General, that was the watchdog for the entire Homeland Security Department, which has 225,000 people plus contractors, and oftentimes are understaffed or really don't have the experience or the skills as investigators to really thoroughly investigate some of these crimes.
So basically, the issue seems to be that the Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection didn't really have the authority to investigate themselves. And on top of that, there was like a turf war on who had the authority to investigate them. Is that right?
That's it. That's exactly it.
So, Andy, you've been working off of a database that you've collected. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, I went and met with some different federal investigators in El Paso and San Diego. And one of the guys in El Paso, he handed me this printout, and basically it was pictures of agents and officers who work along the border who had been busted for corruption. And we thought we could take that data and turn it into a database that we could make forward-facing so readers and viewers could look at it and to try to get a sense of what that corruption looks like and do some data analysis with it. And so I continued to make requests for that information and basically built dossiers on all these different agents. And then with the help of Texas Tribune, we've updated that and enhanced it just recently.
Nina, what's the takeaway from that database?
I think the main takeaway is honestly, Al, that it's the tip of the iceberg. I think you can tell with many stories of these Customs and Border Protection officers that have been caught, you can tell in a lot of their stories that someone else was, you know, someone else may have been involved, that they may have been allowed to do this for years before getting caught. You can tell in cases that some of these folks had met with members of drug cartels trying to recruit them. You can get the sense that these are just a very small fraction, maybe, of those who may be doing something wrong who are still at the agency.
Another story that we had done, we had taken a look at the polygraph exam and some of the results of that. And Al, I'm telling you, it was stunning stuff. I mean, people who admitted that they had contemplated assassinating President Obama, people who had admitted that they had been kidnappers in their previous life, that they had woken up in a pool of blood, didn't know how they got there. Someone admitted killing his kid. But we're talking about people who admitted they'd been sent by drug cartels, that they had been involved in smuggling before they even got on the job. And these people had already gone through the majority of the hiring process.
I think another really interesting part of many of these people's stories is that a lot of them, you know, had a history of distinguished service. I mean, we talked about Joel Luna, and you interviewed David Cruz, Al, at the beginning of the show. Both had done service in the Army or in the Navy. And many of these folks in our database who have been convicted on some pretty severe corruption charges had been in the military before. They had had a history of service to the United States, and then they were caught doing something, you know, totally on the flip side of that.
So there's a new sheriff in town. Mark Morgan is now the head of the Border Patrol. Do you think that's going to help matters at all?
Mark Morgan actually comes from the FBI, and the significance of this is for the first time in the Border Patrol's 92-year history, they have somebody from outside the agency who doesn't wear the green uniform, who didn't come up through the academy, who is running the show on a permanent basis. But there are a lot of questions about, can an outsider really affect change? Will the Border Patrol rally around this guy? Or will they basically look at him and say, you know what, he's not one of us. We're just going to wait him out, wait for the next administration. And, you know, he can say what he says, but he's not our chief.
Well, Nina Satija and Andy Becker of Reveal, I'm sure you guys will keep us informed.
Thanks, Al.
Thanks, Al.
You can see all these people's mugshots and their stories in the database at texastribune.org. Most of this hour, we've concentrated on federal customs and border protection, on graft and corruption in the force that some consider a byproduct of the Department of Homeland Security's rapid growth. There's another consequence to that growth as the U.S. deploys more personnel along its southern border. Migrants take greater risks crossing dangerous desert territory to enter the U.S. Last year, producer Delaney Hall and I traveled to Brooks County, Texas, to get the story of some of those migrants.
Number one, take your emergency.
Yes, somebody speaks Spanish?
Si.
These are 911 calls. They're from undocumented migrants lost in the dense brush country of Brooks County. People asking for help, for water. The air is thick and hot here. The soil is sandy and hard to walk through. Migrants can get very desperate very fast. In this call, a woman is traveling with a man who stopped breathing. A lot of these people don't make it, dying of dehydration and heat stroke. Sometimes their bodies aren't even found on the huge ranches out here. And even when they are, the bodies are almost never identified. Hundreds of families in Latin America know someone who crossed the border and then, somewhere in Brooks County, seemed to vanish.
How are you all this morning?
When migrants make the 911 calls, they're answered at the Brooks County Sheriff's Department. We met up with Chief Deputy Benny Martinez, and he told us that back in 2012, the worst year for migrant deaths in recent memory, his team could barely keep up. He has a small department of just four people. Sometimes they were going out three times a day to pick up bodies.
We weren't doing anything else but that. I didn't have time to think that it was a crisis. This is one of them.
The chief leads us over to a storage closet in the corner of his office. It's full of thick binders.
13. Yes, ma'am, I got it. I thank you.
Each one has pages and pages of pictures of dead bodies in it.
From each recovery we do. It's just, it's hard, you know. You just can't get used to it. I mean, every single one of these persons had a story.
Martinez and his team picked up 129 bodies in 2012. The way it's supposed to work is that each body is collected by a funeral home, then autopsied by a medical examiner to determine if there's been foul play. They're also supposed to take a DNA sample with the hope that the body can someday be identified. But none of that happened. Brooks County is poor and rural without many resources, so everyone was overwhelmed. So overwhelmed that the funeral home simply brought the bodies to Brooks County Cemetery and buried them in a corner set aside for the unidentified dead. Word got out that something was wrong at the cemetery, and those rumors eventually reached a researcher at Baylor University.
I got on the phone and called the sheriff and said, hey, you know, I hear you guys have a problem. Would you like our help? And they're like, yes, please.
This is Dr. Lori Baker. She's a forensic anthropologist and a specialist in border cemeteries. She led a team of students who exhumed the Brooks County graves. The team found bodies buried in milk crates and garbage bags. They found multiple bodies stuffed in the same container, many with no identifying information.
I was angry at the end of last summer. I've never been so angry. I've been frustrated and sad, but this was just appalling. I couldn't believe that anyone would think it's okay to bury someone in a garbage bag.
Over two summers, the team dug up more than 120 bodies that had been buried by a couple of local funeral homes. The details of the burials were shocking. They made headlines for weeks.
The Sacred Heart Cemetery in Falfurrias is supposed to be a place for dignified burials. But what researchers...
Now, the Texas Rangers could soon conduct a preliminary inquiry into the handling of unidentified bodies that were exhumed by anthropologists at...
The state noticed what was going on and assigned the Texas Rangers to look into whether Brooks County had broken any laws. The ranger who handled the investigation spent just 2 days on it. Then he issued his report that found no need to go forward and close the case, even though there were clear violations. That left Dr. Baker and her team to try and identify the bodies with help from researchers at Texas State University. The way the bodies were handled made that process a lot harder.
I think it's hard for some people to understand that, you know, you're processing human remains. It can feel like it's very a gross idea, but when you start doing it, you start realizing how powerful this can be to a family member down the road.
One of Dr. Baker's students, Brooke Morris, is scraping tissue from bone and beginning the painstaking process of reassembling a skeleton.
you know, you're working very intimately with every single bone as you're working through the process. So it's not until you step back and see everything that it really comes together that this is a person who could have been standing right next to you at some point in their life and in your life.
We go into the next room, where Dr. Baker shows us some of the clothing found with the remains of another migrant.
Yeah, it looks like a sock, and then a pair of pants with some kind of fancy stuff on the pocket. So, oh, that's interesting. Mickey Mouse. That seems really sad.
I mean, you could definitely sort of get a sense of, like, what her style was and what, like, who she was a little bit.
Absolutely. I look at this and I see all these people walking around Disney with Mickey Mouse shirts on. And you just kind of think, oh, that's fun.
Dr. Baker's job is to look for clues, anything that might help solve the mystery of where that person came from.
Families deserve to know what happened, especially in a country where we have the resources, the technology, and the expertise to do it. And if we don't do it, it's just wrong. It's absolutely wrong for us not to do this.
Because they do this, Baker and others have increased the prospects that someday somebody will know the names of these anonymous migrants. Their bodies aren't buried in the corners of Brooks County Cemetery anymore. Instead, they're transported to the medical examiner's office in Laredo for proper storage, analysis, and collection of DNA samples.
And I tell my students, virtually every mother that you talk to says about the same thing. Now I have a place to go and pray. Now I have a place to lay flowers. Now I have the ability to go and be with my son or daughter.
That piece was produced by Delaney Hall, based on a story by John Carlos Frey and editor Esther Kaplan at the Investigative Fund. At this point, the only proposed changes to border policy are to deploy more U.S. boots on the ground and extend a wall the width of Mexico. Neither of those ideas address the reality of what's on the ground, an agency with deep-seated problems, security policies that essentially reward some of the worst criminals, and desperate people who somehow breach the barriers and encounter a deadly fate. And before we go, I want to introduce you to one of my favorite podcasts made by one of my favorite podcasters. It's called The Memory Palace, and the man with the magic is Mr. Nate DeMayo. Every episode, Nate tells these short, true stories about the forgotten corners of America's past. These stories are moving, heartbreaking, and hilarious, sometimes all at once. The show is so good, it was named a finalist for a Peabody Award, and Nate was named the Artist in Residence at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The show is brought to you by Radiotopia and PRX. So, subscribe in iTunes or listen at thememorypalace.us. You're going to like the way it sounds. I guarantee it. Our show was edited by Cheryl Duvall. Nina Satija was our lead producer. Production oversight by Mwenda Hasey. Big thanks to Texas Tribune reporters Nicole Cobbler and Kirby Wilson, and editors Dave Pastor, Emily Ramshaw, Corey McLagan, and Blockhouse Studio in Austin, Texas. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our head of studio is Krista Scharfenberg. Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.